morning, everybody. Matthew Bile here with you on 720 WGN, saying goodbye to Patty and her merry band of brothers. God, Raj, that was a long newscast. 224, what the hell are you doing up there?
Well, we had to fit a lot of commercials in, you know.
How are you, buddy?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
I'm doing good.
Excellent.
I'm doing good. It's always good to do crosstalk with Patty and the boys.
It is.
On what's been a rather newsy day.
Very new.
Raj?
Newsy night, yeah.
Newsy night. And so the tax plan is now passed, right? The Senate version of the tax bill has officially passed.
Right.
One Republican flipped, Corker, right? And so it was 51-49? 51-49. Now, I don't know a lot about it because there's a lot to know and not a lot of people know a lot about it. I know there was some discussion amongst the guys here about how much was known or not known. The Democrats are all saying we've had no time to look at it.
Right.
Republicans are saying we've been talking about this for months. You know, basically what the heck's in this. Although it was interesting that some of it was handwritten into the bill. Meaning
that was
that
very
some of it had to have been kind of forced in there a little bit late. And I don't know what to say. I know a lot of people are saying this is going to be really bad for a lot of people. Others are saying it's really good for a lot of people. There's certainly a lot of interesting things in this. And that I'm sure that if we went back over time, there would be a lot of bills that have had a lot of pork and stuff thrown in them. But, private jets not being taxed. Was there something about sushi not being taxed? I saw somebody post. Now, I'm not sure what's real and not real.
Yeah.
I saw something about sushi. Was that in there?
I don't remember seeing anything.
There was something for a college, and is it Michigan that the DeVos family has supported that's going to get some incredible break?
Yeah, the language was written. It was not specifically named in the legislation because you can't legally do that.
But
the legislation
narrow
was written
enough that
so
it could
that
only
it was,
possibly help that school.
That's the only college that qualifies.
Yeah. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, even the guys we're arguing about in here with Patty's show, you know, you'll see people say Obamacare was rammed through. But then you'll see people say there were 40 different hearings and hours of this and this and this and that. So I don't know what the truth is or where it lies. All I know is the Senate has now passed this. The House passed a different bill already. Now these two need to be reconciled.
Right.
And then everybody's got to vote again, correct?
Correct.
And are they saying that's a done deal, that they'll work that out, or is there a possibility that it does still get derailed somewhere?
No one's saying anything right now about the future of whatever potential final bill gets sent to both houses for final approval. I have not seen anything. Everything right now in the news that I'm reading is about what the current Senate bill has and how the Democrats are screaming and yelling about what's happened and the call to action to the public to call their senators their representatives and make a case for not passing whatever eventually, you know, comes out of the committee.
Yeah. So we'll follow that, and I guess we'll learn a lot more about what is in this bill in the days and weeks to come as it's more widely available. I saw Senator Durbin on the floor tonight, a live Facebook video somebody had out, and he was going on about the bullet points that all of the special interest groups had out. He's like, this is how we're learning about the bill, from the special interest groups sending bullet points of what's in this bill.
Yeah.
And, you know, 500 pages is an awful lot of bill. And I know that a lot of the things were discussed, but it would be nice for everybody, for both sides, no matter who's in power, because it goes back and forth all the time. And it's going to keep doing that, right? It would be good that there would be a rule that once a bill is introduced, if it's over 12 pages or something, there should be some rule about an amount of time before a bill is introduced and handed to everyone before it can be voted on. There should be like a 5-day waiting period, just like we can't pass with guns, you know, because it seems wrong, no matter who the party is in control, that, and it should be the same for Democrats. If they're someday when they're in control again, they shouldn't be able to ram through legislation. It should have to have time, a certain amount of time for. And I know they have their rules, but there should be a certain amount of time for discussion that was very limited tonight. Right. 2 minutes. Per person or 2 minutes.
Right.
I don't know what it was.
The chair put some strict limits on open discussion.
Yeah. So there should be some basic minimums. Now, maybe that was already met. I don't know, but it seems like if they got the bill tonight and it's 500 pages, you can't vote on it 2 hours later.
Well, you run into problems then. You run into some serious problems. If the nation needs to issue a declaration of war, you need to do that immediately.
Well, that in 12 pages or less.
But usually something like that is 12 pages or less. Okay. But what I'm saying is that you can't tie the hands of Congress with a time limit or grace period between the time a piece of legislation is submitted and the time they can vote on it. There are other actions that require immediate action. Excuse me. By Congress in order to get things going. And so, if you want to write those, if you want to write a new law that does what you want it to do, but then put in except for this, this, and this, but you're going to have to delineate that.
Well, that's 12 pages or less. Boom.
Yeah, but still, it's
still
legislation.
You want to start a war, keep it to 11 pages. Well, but then everybody could sit there and read it in half an hour and say, okay, I'm cool with this, or not. I mean, you can't say, well, it's got to get done so we can't have that limit. People have to vote on it. You don't want bad war legislation passed because people didn't have time to see what was really in the bill. I mean, it's bad.
Well, it's fairly straightforward. Something like that is a fairly straightforward
declaration.
All right,
declaration. Well, then it wouldn't apply. There would be less than 12 pages. You could read it, you could debate it, and you could vote on it. I don't believe, Roger, I'm not going to go along with, they really need the power to get things done quickly. It's Congress, for God's sake. How often are they even there? How many days a week, a year are they working? I mean, come on. This is not like they're the speed and efficiency unit of UPS and we can't have constraints on us because we're getting all these packages out on time.
I think
it's Congress.
I think the point that you're upset about is not that they didn't have time to read this. The main portions of this bill have been debated for some time. What we're upset about, I think, is the fact that these last-minute changes were made, and as you pointed out, some handwritten and photocopied and handed out to members of Congress at the last minute, and that these changes, these last-minute addendums to the main package, there was not enough time to look at it, and that there were charges that lobbyists were the ones actually writing these addendums.
Well, and I'm not even going to get all into that because I would guarantee you that when Obama was in charge and Clinton was in charge and everybody, lobbyists wrote a lot of legislation that came through senators' hands. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it, right? So that's not a partisan issue, I don't think. But I'm sure it's more about the addendums. You're right. I'm sure a lot of this was discussed. But if it's a 500-page bill, you need time to digest that and be able to argue and debate what that actually is.
But again, I think they've had time to debate the majority of that, the meat of the bill.
I think the Democratic senators will tell you they have not.
Well, yeah, but of course.
This is being thrown out there and there hasn't been time to discuss it. I'm just saying that once a bill is finally introduced, there should be a certain amount of time allowed to actually.
Well, the Democrats want it until Monday morning.
That's not that long. That's not that long. All right, we're late for news again.
Really?
Yeah. I hope not much has changed. 2:33 in the morning. Let's get the headlines with Roger. Hello, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. The phone number, 312-981-7200. Alan is calling in from North Carolina. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm good. Are you actually in North Carolina right now?
Yes.
Are you listening to us on the stream, or are we coming through over the nice nighttime airwaves?
I've gone to the stream. It's easier.
I hear you. But you can get us probably sometime, especially this time of night, right?
This time of year, I used to, I had like a small, really good AM signal receiver, and I listened to you by radio until the live streaming and the iHeartRadio.
Sure.
And
made life a little easier.
Yeah, but actually the iHeart doesn't maybe it's my phone, but it's not working as well. So I just go straight to your site.
Okay. All right. Excellent. What did you want to say, sir?
Well, I've been wondering, you know, the with the tax bill, and everyone keeps saying no one has read it, no one has read it.
Mm-hmm.
Are there federal, are there state attorneys general that can challenge this in federal court, saying, if you haven't read it, how can it be constitutional?
Well, I doubt that, Alan. I doubt that a state attorney general could do anything about that. Now, I just don't think they have. I don't think they have rules in place that say it has to be read a certain amount or anything like that. The writers of the bill would say it's been read, and probably everybody on the Republican side would say, "Listen, it's been read through. The parts have been read through. We all agree on this enough." So I don't think everybody's going to. Now the Democrats are saying, "Listen, this all just got handed to us. We haven't had time to read it." Roger, like just said, you know, they've been debating the major parts of this for months, and you know, the Democrats knew what was going to be in here. So there are a lot of little bits and addendums and stuff like that that haven't been read through. But as far as we can tell, that's not necessarily unconstitutional. Thank you for the call, Alan. Maybe it should be. Maybe it shouldn't be. I would propose that anything over 12 pages, you get at least a day to read it, for goodness sakes. And if it's 530-some pages, including some in cursive that I saw online, it doesn't look very legible. In fact, Senator Durbin made that point when mm-hmm. he was on the floor saying, you know, some states don't even require cursive writing, but somebody here apparently still can do it. And he said that the when they were handed the bill, because there were, you know, they're writing in hand on addendums here, that actually some of it was cut off, that the whole sentences weren't actually in it. When they photocopied the thing, the cursive, the handwritten part, was cut off. There were only bits and phrases of the addendum that was in there. So they're voting on something that they literally don't even have the exact language of in the bill they were handed.
And another aside to all this, one of the other complaints by the Democrats has been that of all the addendums that have been placed on the bill, a lot of them have nothing to do, in their opinion, with the tax code. They have nothing to do with that.
Well, of course not, but that happens all the time, right?
Well, here's one major one. They have repealed, the bill contains a repealment of the requirement that all Americans obtain health insurance.
Yep.
And that goes directly against Obamacare, and the Republicans hoping to open up health care to all people by giving them a choice. And the experts, the financial experts outside of Congress, say that millions of people will lose their coverage. Millions of people currently covered by Obamacare will lose their coverage. So things like that, the Obamacare repealment of the requirement, and a lot of other things that many people would not consider to be eligible for this tax plan, that has nothing to do with taxes or anything else, and they just want to change things around for their own good. And again, like you said, that one college gets a tax break.
People that own private jets get a tax break.
Yeah.
There's a lot of hanky stuff in this. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. There is no doubt about it. All right. 312-981-7200. I want to talk. This is something that really got glossed over this week. I sent this to John Williams, and he talked about it on his show. But there is such an attack on the media and journalism these days, promoted most often by our President Trump. And he's always calling out the New York Times, Washington Post, NBC, CNN. He, you know, there's overseas incidents now where governments are defending what they're doing by saying CNN is fake news when CNN has reported on things that, I forget if it was in Libya or where it was. They're defending, saying, oh, even their president says that's fake news. It's amazing what's being done to attack journalism. And it went really far in the Post. Washington Post was basically getting catfished into writing a story on Judge Moore, and they caught it and they exposed it, and we'll talk about that next. 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. Matt Pabala with you here. 2:49 in the morning on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio in the historic Tribune Tower as we await the move to our new studios, which will be south of Michigan, south of the river here on Michigan Avenue.
Just barely south.
Just barely south. Not too far away. We'll be a stone's throw away.
Mm-hmm. If you got a good arm.
True. True. I've had surgery. I wouldn't be able to make it.
And if you do, Cubs are looking for you.
And they got millions to give you.
Yep.
All right. So real quick, while we have a few minutes here, I want to talk about this story. I don't know if you saw it this week, Roger. The Washington Post, you know, they've been doing a lot of work on the Roy Moore, the judge from Alabama running for Senate, who has been accused of sexual harassment, sexual assault somewhat, maybe. I don't exactly know how to term everything. Basically, he was dating underage girls. And this is a long, this is like 30 years ago, right?
Right.
Which maybe wasn't considered quite as bad back then. I know that some moms said no way. He was very interesting because he asked the mother's permissions to date their 14, 15, 16-year-old daughters, which is an interesting form of Southern hospitality, I guess. And there was, I remember reading one woman saying her mom said you'd be crazy not to, because here was an upstanding good man, an adult with a good job, with a career.
Sure.
And so some looked at it as you're way too young. Don't you dare go near him. Mm-hmm. And some, I think, thought, hey, that's boy, what a great, you know, if you're going to date a man, this is a good upstanding man. So they approved of that. It was a different time, but it wasn't the 40s. This was the 80s. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not that long ago. I was growing up in the 80s. So it's all over the place. But the Post is doing a lot of work and talking to the women. And I think that the reporting I've read on this and other scandals lately, especially in the era of all the sexual assault allegations that have come to light, I think the reporting has been really good in that every time I read an accusation, the outlet seems to be saying, we spoke with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so who all said they did hear this story back when it first happened or 5 years later. Or they'll say this person didn't want to come forward because they have had financial difficulties and were worried how this would look. And then they report on the person's financial difficulties. I mean, it's been thorough, I feel like, a lot of the reporting. I'm sure there's been some not great reporting out there. But I do believe in my heart that overall, reporters and journalists at the Chicago Tribune, at the LA Times, at the Washington Post, at the New York Times, the credible, venerable institutions of our country, I do believe they are trying to do true journalistic work, whether it's good or bad for whatever they believe. I do believe journalists try to, reporters, not columnists necessarily who are tasked with something different, but the reporters who are on the ground and chasing these down, I do believe they have the truth in their heart, and that's what they're trying to get out. I do believe that overall. Of course, there are going to be problems in any line of work, in anything in the world. There will be people who aren't as good, who don't do the work they should, whatever. I do believe that. I do believe still in the media. I do believe in these institutions. Okay. So the Post had a big expose this week about being contacted after the accusations against Roy Moore started coming out. They got an email that said Roy Moore in Alabama in the subject line. And somebody was writing saying, hey, I've got a story about Roy in Alabama, but I haven't said it for years. Maybe it should say that way. I'm not sure what to do. And so they wrote these kind of teasing emails to Post reporters saying they've got a story, not telling what it is. Saying, you know, I'm afraid to talk about this on the phone. I need to know I'd be protected. So a reporter goes and meets with this woman in a, I believe, a Virginia suburban mall. The person who wrote the email set up, let's meet here. When the reporter got there, the person was already there.
Right.
The subject. And so they sat down and talked to her. And the person who had the accusation kept trying to get the reporter to say what this would do to Roy Moore. Can you guarantee me this will end his campaign? And like asking the reporter to give their opinion, to give their, you know, feeling about Roy Moore and things like that. And it sounds like the reporters weren't doing that. They were saying, well, we can't tell you what would happen from this. We don't know. We need more information. We need more corroboration. We need to know a lot of things before we'd ever run with this. And then so what the Post does, of course, is goes back and runs a background check on this person making the allegation. She said she worked at a mortgage company. She said this. She said that. They start searching her name. They find that there was a GoFundMe page for somebody who wanted to move to the New York area. And it seems to be that person who was looking for a job in journalism who had said on Facebook, I'm going to, basically sound like they're going to try to. I don't want to get this wrong because I don't want to be a bad journalist myself because I'm not. I'm just a broadcaster. Mm-hmm. But basically, they started finding a lot of weird stuff.
Right.
And they weren't sure if it was this person or not because they just use a very common name, that it could have been anybody. And then, but they called the mortgage company where she said she worked, and they said, well, we don't have any record of that person ever working here.
Mm-hmm.
So then they set up the next meeting with the person, and they realize, oh, and there was also a tie to this Project Veritas. And Project Veritas is a funded thing that's trying to play gotcha with the quote, left press, the mainstream media, the problem in this country, by getting them to print stories that are knowingly false and then say, gotcha. So they figure this out, that she seems to be part of this. So they have the next meeting with her, and unbeknownst to her, the Post brings a videographer with them, two guys that sit at the table next to them, and they are taping this now. They're taping this on camera and stuff.
But she has also been taping.
Well, they didn't know this for sure at the time, right? But I think the second time the reporter sits down, she purposely places her purse next to that person's purse to try to block whatever they have there. Yeah. And then that person moved their purse.
Mm-hmm.
And so then they start asking, well, you know, we did some background research on you as we said we would. And, you know, here's this GoFundMe thing. What was this all about? Well, I wanted to move and da, da, da. Okay. And where do you work? Well, I told you I work at the mortgage firm. Well, we called that company and they don't have any record of you. Well, all right. Maybe I don't want to do this. Maybe this. And they start backing off. I said, well, those guys next to us are videotaping this and we're going to run this story. So this is your chance to say whatever you want to say, if you want to come clean, if you want to tell us the truth. And the person kept denying. They kept trying to say, okay, well, I didn't say anything on the record. And they're like, well, it is on the record. And we're going to talk about this. And the Post wrote about, you know, off the record conversations with us are off the record, but not if you're trying to dupe us, not if you're trying to scam us. Right. Then we're not honoring your off the recordness of this. And I think that was fair that they said that and said, hey, we're running with this story. You're out here trying to scam us. Think of all the hours that the Post wasted running a background check, searching out, calling these places, going to these stupid meetings because this person wanted to play gotcha, this group, this organization. And so then the Post followed this person the next day. They drove into the parking lot and went into the offices of Project Veritas.
And she was there.
And she was, yeah. They saw her go in.
Yeah.
And then they tried to talk to the guy who runs it, walked out at some point. So they went up and talked to him and he wouldn't say anything. But
right. But
basically, they completely caught her in this. And there's been such an attack by President Trump and others on journalists. And listen, is journalism always fair and balanced? No, clearly not. Fox News is not. MSNBC is not. CNN, I do believe, tries to be. I do believe NBC, CBS, and ABC try to be, and the Times and the Post, I do believe they all try to be. President Trump has no problem quoting the New York Times when it's something bad about Hillary Clinton or one of the Democrats. It's fake news when he doesn't like what they're writing. And I think all politicians have that issue. I think President Trump didn't have to face that forever, so it's much harder for him to put up with because it drives him crazy. But they're out there trying to do good work, and we need to support them. All right, news coming up, 720 WGN. Hey, Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. After the 3:30 a.m. news, we'll go live to Hawaii, where they tested the nuclear warning system for the first time in, I think, about 50 years. We'll hear what that was like and what they hope that that's going to help with. Because maybe I'm wrong, but Raj, if we got a 20-minute warning right now, what would we do?
I'd go running outside, flailing my arms, screaming.
Well, you're the warning system then. That's all we need.
I would be loud enough. People have told me my voice carries.
We'll talk about that after the 3:30 a.m. news. Right now, joining us on the phone is our old friend Chris Williamson from the Chasing Earhart podcast and the Chasing Earhart Project. ChasingEarhart.com is the website. Chris, how are you this morning? What did I do? What did I do wrong? Chris, are you there?
I sure am. Hey, how you doing, Matt?
I think I hit the wrong button. I'm good. How are you?
I am well. Doing well.
We appreciate you staying up late for us. The latest edition I'm reading on the website right now, ChasingEarhart.com, the latest podcast that you guys have out has an interview that was done with the last person known to speak with Amelia Earhart on her fateful voyage. Now, that's not an interview you guys can do now, because that person, I imagine, is long gone. But it's pieces of an interview they did back in 1973. Is that right?
Yeah. It's actually going to be coming out tomorrow. Later on tonight, actually. It's Saturday night it comes out. So it's one of our icon interviews. It's with Leo Bellart. And he was the last person to actually speak with Earhart when she famously said the lines, we must be on you but cannot see you, and she was kind of communicating with the Itasca, and he is the chief radio man on the Itasca. So it's a very interesting interview to get some of that insight when it comes to Amelia Earhart's sort of final moments. Yeah. And the last person to speak with her.
So where she goes down, is it considered the Pacific where she was?
Yeah. So she went down in the Pacific, right in the middle of the Pacific, kind of right near Howell on the island, according to Mr. Bellart and a lot of other folks who believe that she did crash and sink in the ocean. So she was, on the last leg of her journey. She had about 7,000 miles to go, and this was a good chunk of that 7,000, about 2,500 of those 7,000 miles, and that's where she went down, and where all the issues happened, and that's the last we heard of Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan.
So when Bellart was interviewed in 1973, his belief was that she crashed and sank and just died in the ocean.
Yes, he as he put it, he always believed that she went into the drink, and that she, he kind of believed that. And it's interesting to kind of hear the logs, the actual logs that he wrote, and that as he heard them, and as he was hearing her words, he wrote down exactly what he heard. And he always believed, and most of the folks aboard the Itasca, matter of fact, actually all the folks aboard the Itasca, always believed that she went down into the ocean.
Was that just the general belief back then? Was it only years later that the island, that pieces were discovered on an island, or that there was thinking that it could have landed on this island? Were those theories more later? Was everybody back at that time more of just the general thought that, she crashed?
Yeah, I think that was really the general consensus, that she crashed in the ocean. That was the official, and still is, the official United States government, explanation for what happened to Mr. Earhart and Mr. Noonan. So it was really, really at the time, kind of the only option. And then, several years later, some of these hypotheses that are being worked now to this day started kind of, becoming, I guess, were birthed and started becoming worked. And at that point, because the whole kind of Pandora's box opened as far as what happened to her.
All right. So there was a History Channel documentary over the summer that was, very interesting or gained interest because of this photograph that claimed that it could be Fred Noonan and Amelia Earhart and a wrecked plane being dragged by a boat off in the distance. Before we go into the controversy that came after the special about the photograph, tell me what you think again about the photograph itself, because it's not like you're seeing Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan in the photograph. You're like, she's got her back to the camera. She's got a short haircut, and that's the giveaway. Forensically looking at him, it looks like his receding hairline and things like that. When you look at the photograph, do you think this is more people wanting to believe it's them, or do you think there's actually some fire to that smoke?
Well, it's certainly possible. The Japanese capture hypothesis has been worked since the 1960s, when Fred Gerner sort of opened that whole hole of all that work that's been done since then. So this particular photograph, was located, it was found in the National Archives. Really nothing gets in the National Archives by accident. They just kind of came across this thing. And it's certainly compelling. I can see where people would imagine that this could be, in fact, Amelia and Fred. If it is, in fact, it's being worked at the moment to actually be verified. And if it is verified to be 100% legitimate, you really have you really have the closest thing ever to a smoking gun. Everybody keeps talking about the smoking gun in this case, and of course that in this case would be the plane or remains of some kind. But, you know, if this photo is to be determined to be real completely, and it is actually being them, this is a smoking gun because you have, as you said, Amelia, you've got Fred, you've got what appears to be a Japanese ship towing on a barge, something that looks an awful lot like the Lockheed Electra Tenny, the flying laboratory, as Amelia called it. So, you know, it's just one of those things. The Japanese capture hypothesis has been largely eyewitness testimony based, you know, this whole time. Yeah. And now they have something that's sort of a physical, possibly a physical, tangible piece of evidence that they can kind of go on. And, you know, we've talked to a lot of the players in that documentary, and the original documentary was slated to be 4 hours. So there's more. There's a lot more that they have. And they're actually working on a part two of that documentary, believe it or not. And hopefully that will come out probably in the next year or two. And, you know, we've talked to them, and they stand behind that photo 100% is, in fact, them.
Well, let's talk about that, because then after the special comes out, a history blogger in, I believe in Japan, says that, no, this photo was printed in a book 2 years before Amelia crashed. And the History Channel came out right away saying we'll look further into this, et cetera, et cetera. But I haven't heard anything more about that. Do we know when that photo was actually taken, or was it truly in a book that was published 2 years before she crashed?
Well, there's been speculation as to whether or not it's actually been a book, or if it's actually an official book, or just a bunch of, you know, images and stuff thrown together by a loose kind of binding, and just, you know, that's kind of how it worked at that point, and that's how they did it. So, you know, when the blogger came out with this, you know, really pretty much right after it happened, it really obviously made it very controversial, that whole thing, because this was really the centerpiece of that whole special. You know, before this came out, you got to remember the photo dropped during the anniversary of the disappearance last year. Mm-hmm. So ahead of the actual documentary. So as soon as that photo dropped, as you mentioned, History got out in front of it and you know, decided that they were going to launch their own investigation. And we have not heard anything. No one's been privy to that information yet, but I can tell you that the people that were involved in that documentary immediately went out to Saipan, immediately started doing research on what the Japanese blogger stated, you know, was in fact a photo that was taken from a Japanese travel log book in 1935, which would have been 2 years prior to the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. And it's still being worked at this point. And I think there's getting ready to be some stuff that'll be coming out pretty soon here that will kind of be the next steps in that investigation, whether it goes, you know, the way of proving that photo is true or whether it's not, we're all going to have to wait and find out.
It sounds to me, Chris, like you're privy to a little bit of information on how that investigation is going, and you're holding back on me.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm holding back on you. I would say that I'm just allowing the folks that originally broke that particular photo to kind of, you know, steer the ship, and so to speak, because those are the people. You got to keep in mind, these guys have been working this for 30 years of their lives. It's everything to them. And the gentleman who broke it, Les Kinney, is a really great guy, very knowledgeable. He's been researching Earhart for 30 years of his life, 10 years now full time. I imagine that they're getting ready to do something with this photo to kind of push this in the next, you know, I guess in the next step, into the next step, I should say. So we'll see. We're not as privy as I'd like to be, but I can tell you that from the folks I've talked to regarding, you know, that special, I don't think it's over. I think there's a lot more that's going to be coming. I think it's just the tip of the iceberg.
From the tone of your voice, I think you're hoping that they've got some good stuff coming out. So we'll sit by and wait. That's fine.
Yeah.
Now, definitely. USA Today had a story earlier this week about a gentleman who says his uncle worked at the prison where Earhart and Noonan were taken and killed, according to this guy who said his uncle told him the story way back in the day. What do we know about this?
Well, it's just really, you know, it's just the next piece of eyewitness testimony. I mean, the you know, the Japanese and the people in the islands of Saipan, this was just second nature for them to know that they were there. You know, it's part of their history, according to them. And, you know, we've spoken with folks, representatives of the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and they have told us that, look, it, you know, they stand by their ancestors. This is stuff that was passed down generation to generation. Nobody has any reason to lie. You know, it's just all there. It's all put out there. And this guy, you know, Bill, his name is Bill Sablon, and you know, he, it's not old news, to be honest with you. You know, Joe Jervis and Fred Gerner, you know, talked to his parents and his uncle and everything back in the 60s. So this is just sort of the next piece of eyewitness testimony. And as we both know, that the Japanese capture is, you know, 99% based on eyewitness testimony. And it just, I think it's not the end of it. It'll keep coming. I don't think, I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. So it's very interesting. I think it's a very personal, intimate connection to Earhart and Noonan, if they were in fact there, that his uncle worked at the prison where they were held. And, there's no reason for them to lie, according to, you know, their ancestors and according to the Republic of the Marshall Islands. There just isn't. It just kind of is what it is. And it's always been very interesting to see that, because these people don't really seem to care if you believe them or not. They're just kind of telling you history. It's almost as if we would say, well, you know, this is what happened when they signed the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, it just is what it is. It's, yeah, our history. It's sort of the same concept here. And so, it's been interesting to see that kind of combated with, you know, the scientific approach that other folks are taking to other hypotheses that are being worked. And, you know, if you look at it like a jury trial case, you have to ask yourself, what's more relevant? What's more credible? You know, if you have 200 eyewitnesses versus, you know, a group of circumstantial evidence, what would you pick? What would you be convinced by? So it's very interesting to see it.
So this happened 80 years ago, right? 80 years ago. Is there, you know, we just opened up all these documents about the JFK case.
Yes.
Do you believe, so, you know, there's speculation that the U.S. government knew that maybe even the remains were relocated.
Right.
Are there documents, are there sealed documents that could be released, do you believe? Do we know if there are documents that are top secret or anything like that, that the government could release if they wanted to?
I can tell you with almost absolute certainty that there is, that they have documentation on what truly happened to Amelia Earhart. Now, whether that gets revealed to be, hey guys, she just crashed and sank, I'm sorry, that's it. Or yes, there's some truth to the fact that she was captured by the Japanese, or, you know, whatever else that could be on within those documents that are sealed right now. There is stuff to be uncovered. There's, you know, there's been hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests that have been filed with folks that are working various hypotheses regarding the Japanese capture, you know, under the Japanese capture umbrella. And there's been a lot of, you know, FOIA requests that have been denied, which is very interesting. Why would you deny it if it's not something important, you know, if there's something that's crucial there that they don't want people to know about? So you got to keep in mind that, you know, she was very tight with FDR and Eleanor Roosevelt at the time. Mm-hmm. This is something, you know, FDR is, you know, widely touted is a very beloved president. And if something were to happen at that point, or even now, let's say, to get out that he was either directly or indirectly involved in the disappearance by either setting her up to do something that she wasn't really comfortable with doing, or, you know, the list goes on and on and on, it can really change history, not only with Amelia Earhart, but with FDR. It really can send ripples throughout, you know, different people's paths and different people's histories. So, you know, I think that's why it's very kind of a touchy subject when it comes to releasing those documents, if they do in fact exist. And I believe that there's more to the story than what is being told, obviously.
Well, ultimately, if the documents were going to be released, who has the ultimate power to decide that?
Well, I think it really kind of falls on the president. You know, he was the one that kind of, you know, gave the go ahead and the green light to release and okay the JFK stuff.
Right.
I think if tomorrow President Trump decided he wanted to, you know, let's just release everything we have on Earhart, I think it'd be a lot of mighty interested people. I mean, obviously the History Channel documentary, if it proved anything at all, and I talked to Dick Spink, we had him on the podcast a few episodes back, and I told him if it proves anything at all, it's that the world still is very deeply invested in what happened to Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan. And I think if that were to be suddenly released and he were to okay that, I think you have a lot of mighty interested parties wanting to go through those documents and see exactly what happened, because there's all kinds of interesting stuff that could have possibly happened.
I think you're absolutely right. I think there would be a lot of fascination about it. And I think that, Chris, this is a golden opportunity for you guys, because President Trump, I don't know if you've heard, but there's been a lot of stuff in the news that maybe isn't the most fun for him to have people reading about. And, you know, what a great diversion to have some other type of news, quite honestly, especially if it shows that some other president maybe did things, a beloved president that people didn't love. I think that you guys should be appealing somehow through Trump's people directly to President Trump to say, hey, this is 80 years old. There is no reason to hold this back. Now you've got a great relationship with the prime minister from Japan. And this was a different time. And let's release this so that we can, you know, solve one of America's great mysteries. I could see him being like, yeah, what the hell? Let's do it.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think he might just decide he would want to do that. And, you know, we're working on that. And I'm sure we're not the only ones. There's a lot of people that would be mighty interested in that. So, you know, it's really, this whole thing has just been as sort of like an observer, which is what our team is. I mean, because we're sort of compartmentalizing everything, just putting everything together for folks out there. It's certainly interesting. And it's certainly a lot of fun to see everything that's happened. Just, you know, every time an Earhart story breaks, you mentioned she's a great diversion. People love to kind of revisit her story and revisit the mystery. And it is really the greatest missing persons case and probably of all. Yeah. What happened to this woman? She just disappeared. Her and Fred just disappeared and vanished off the face of the earth. And we truly don't know. And really, that's kind of the most compelling thing that general audiences are just, you know, clamoring for. That's, you know, we watch it all the time. People are, you know, they'll post something like the coconut crabs thing that was in the news recently. And they'll post, you know, the story that we've just been talking about with the gentleman regarding his uncle in the prison. I mean, every time something comes up, regardless of what it is and regardless of how big or small it is, it really continues to capture the imagination. It's just another little piece of evidence. And, you know, building a case is like building a house. Every little piece helps. And so these people are just, you know, they're excited to learn more. And I think it's just an interesting kind of thing to look at and observe.
It really is. And to think about 80 years later, how interested we are in it. Imagine at the time that she was so famous and so popular at the time, right? This would be like, who would be the modern day equivalent that if they just disappeared off the face of the earth? I don't know. Maybe it's like Brad Pitt or Angelina Jolie I don't know, who, somebody who's just so, you know, Michael Jordan, somebody who's just so famous around the world, just disappearing off the face of the earth, that would drive us insane. It's as if Princess Diana went into that tunnel and just never came out the other end.
Right. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I would imagine someone like a Richard Branson or a Musk or someone like that just kind of just disappear off the face of the earth, and that was it. It just evaporated into thin air, it appears. People want to know, and this mystery is you know, as Americans, we love a good mystery, and we don't love, or we don't like, when things are just left undone. And this is the biggest undone, one of the biggest undones ever. You know, what in the world happened to this woman who really was, you know, I mean, this is a woman at the time was just a fearless adventurer. You know, she had a handle on fear. She, you know, she famously said, you know, I thought about what would happen if I didn't make it back. And if I did, you know, once I thought about it and gave it a little bit of attention, there really was no reason to revisit it. It was a thought, and that was it. And, she went for it, and she did something incredibly heroic. And Fred Noonan, who was her navigator, was incredibly heroic for going with her in doing this, because at the time, I mean, you know, the equatorial route they were taking, and it hadn't been done, you know, and it was just, it was scary. And you got to keep in mind that they made it 3/4 of the way around the world.
Yeah.
You know, they were on their way home. You know, they're 7,000 miles away. And, you know, it's a really sad thing that at the very end they just didn't quite make it. But I think it really speaks to you know, her impact and her legacy now, that look, you can have, do or be anything you want. You can truly go after whatever you want. And if you fail, you fail, but at least you go after it. And, that impact really it still resonates. It still sends ripples now to the, you know, I can't tell you how many 8 or 9 year old kids I see dressed up as Amelia Earhart still 80 years later. There's a reason why this woman impacted the entire planet and continues to do so. And I think because of that, and because of that impact, and because of that legacy, we're always going to want to know, and we're always going to be searching. And it's really part of the United States mentality. You know, military mentality. We bring everybody home, you know, and she was never brought home, and we want to bring her home. And that's kind of, I think that's a sentiment that a lot of our guests, you know, we have over 200 guests in the project, and I think it's a sentiment that a lot of those folks share. They want to bring her home. They want to have some kind of finality, regardless of what it is. You know, they want it to be some kind of final end to her story. And it's just the last chapter hasn't been written yet. It's continually written, as a matter of fact.
Chris Williamson from the ChasingEarhart.com website and podcast, the new podcast out later today with the last man who spoke to Amelia Earhart. And there's a documentary in the works, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah, we're working on it. We've been shooting the documentary since March of this year, and we've got approximately 200 hours of footage already. We could probably put a documentary out right now, but we're going to be shooting probably for the better part of 2018. And maybe even a little bit into 2019, and we're tentatively planning for a fall of 2019 release, but that could push a little bit depending on, you know, kind of distribution
sure,
and all that.
Sure, absolutely. ChasingEarhart.com. Chris, we'll chat with you again as further news warrants, okay?
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure, sir.
Thank you for jumping on the phone again. ChasingEarhart.com. Fascinating stuff in that podcast with the last person to talk to Amelia. Sounds really good, too. 328 News next, 720 WGN. It's 3:32 in the morning. Let's get the news headlines. Roger Badish. Matt Bavala with you here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. How are you doing? We're here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue in the historic Tribune Tower building that has been around since, what is it, Roger? I think 22, somewhere in there. Mm-hmm. It's been around a really long time.
A long time.
Since before we had nuclear weapons, mm-hmm. and then since we did. And I'm sure here in Chicago, I don't think we ever had a separate sound for nuclear war, did we? We just had air raid sirens.
Correct.
That could have been for anything. Mm-hmm. Most famously were to celebrate the 1959 White Sox championship, right?
That's right, and that scared a whole bunch of people.
Mary Daly had the air raid sirens go off yep. when the Sox won, I guess, the AL pennant, because mm-hmm. they didn't win the World Series in 59. They must have right. just clinched the AL pennant. Mm-hmm. Air raid sirens went off. People freaked out. Yep. It was 59, so it's not like we weren't still in the, you know, Cold War,
Cold
nuclear
War.
Age, right?
Yeah.
And that freaked people out mm-hmm. just a little bit.
Just a tad.
As will happen. Yeah. Anthony Quintano is a journalist in Hawaii who joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Anthony, how are you this morning?
Doing good. And how are you guys doing?
We're doing okay. Anthony, I have a little sound to play for you. Tell me if this is what you heard earlier today in Hawaii. So that is some audio we have from your website, civilbeat.org, where you cover things for Honolulu, and that is I believe an air, the siren that went off after the normal tsunami siren that you guys test, I believe, once on the first of every month. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yes,
first of every month.
It's
I believe
that we're fairly used to.
Yeah, at 11:45 a.m., the tsunami one went off first for about a minute, and then this siren that we just played went off. Is that right?
That's correct.
And the tsunami siren sounds not that much different. Do you know, is it the same siren? They just sort of deviate the sound a little bit? It's that sort of, that sounded to me, quite honestly, like if I heard that sound, I would think there's an ambulance coming or police cars coming in the 1950s. It sounds a little like something like that to me.
It's very, very close. Yeah, it's the same tone, just as the civil defense refers to it as a wailing tone. And it is very similar to law enforcement or emergency medical services sound, but obviously much louder if you're close
sure.
to the sirens, as I was today.
Sure. So you guys test the tsunami sirens every month. It's all the same equipment, right? It's just the same. It's just a sound, a deviated sound coming out of all the same equipment on the island.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
So it's all been in place forever. It's used for tsunamis. Was all of that equipment originally built not as a tsunami warning system, but as a nuclear warning system?
No, it was built with emergency in mind, but with the idea that you could expand upon it if needed. Obviously, that was the case back when they were built, and now they stepped back and they've now revived it. I'm not clear as to when exactly they were built, but they made it so that it was capable of expanding the tone that it emitted.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that these haven't been tested, that tone hasn't been tested since the Cold War ended, a long time ago, maybe over 50 years since that siren played. And I'm wondering if when they built that, if it was built for nuclear warnings back in the day or whatever warnings, I mean, how long have tsunami warnings been around? How long has the technology been around? Is that really old technology, or is that more like in the last 30 years that a good system for warning about a tsunami has been around?
Well, I know fairly recently the sirens have been updated. I'm not sure exactly when the sirens were installed. I mean, tsunamis for Hawaii have been a problem for a very long time. So it's most likely that was the case at the time. I know that the sirens were, in the last couple of years, revamped. They looked very, almost like what you would imagine as like a cartoon siren, a really elongated horn-looking device. And now they are very circular and much smaller and not all that high off the ground either. So I know they have updated that technology fairly recently across the island.
So you were warned, you were told, you know, we saw news that Hawaii was going to test these sirens for the first time in forever. What have they told you on the island about what you do if it ever really, if there is an attack? And if they do issue these warning sirens, it's supposed to, from what I've read, give you a 20 minutes heads up. But I don't know what I would do if I got a 20 minute, hey, nuclear bomb coming to Chicago. I'm 45 minutes away from my family where I'm at right now. I think Jess and I would just hug each other and go down and keep broadcasting until the I don't know what you actually do if a nuclear warhead is headed towards your city. Are they giving you that information as well?
So they've held a number of public meetings, civil defense, in order to inform people the right way. And the sirens are actually one of three different ways to be notified of this particular type of emergency. The other is the television with the emergency alert system and via text message. And so if you didn't hear the siren or whatever, you'd be alerted two other ways. And as far as the timing goes, they do emphasize that there is a very good chance that there's probably not all that much you can do. And it's actually probably going to, a missile attack would probably take only about 12 to 15 minutes to hit Hawaii. So they do suggest that you run to the closest concrete bunker or shelter. There is no public shelter, so it would be basically a basement or an apartment building, something along those lines. But they do emphasize, and they have been emphasizing, that the chance of a nuclear attack here is very unlikely, and they repeat that over and over again. But they also do remind people that these missiles are not very accurate. And so if a missile attack were to occur, it is a possibility that it may not necessarily hit land, but maybe just offshore, which then would decrease the amount of destruction or impact. So there are so many variables that could occur that you might possibly have a chance.
Really uplifting news, isn't it? You know, it might miss, it might hit the water, it might just kill everything else in the world. We might just burn and still survive. I mean, it's really such an unknown. And you know, while they're stressing, listen, there's very little chance of this, you're still in your mind thinking, but not as much chance as for the last 50 years when you didn't bother testing these sirens at all, right? And
there's a lot of ironies with everything that has gone on with it. Yes. But they do feel, they try to emphasize the seriousness about this, and it really, they're just saying, and there's been a lot of humor. I mean, in the comments of our posts, when we share the videos regarding the siren attack, siren warning, that a lot of people saying this is all just kind of pointless. Really, they're just kind of doing the best they can to help prepare.
Sure. Well, and so I read in the story here that it says Hawaii no longer has any nuclear shelters. When the Cold War ended, funding for maintaining them ran out as the threat of attack ended. So has there been any talk? Are there dilapidated nuclear shelters? Is there talk of funding some sort of way to try to protect people? Or is it just, we're going to give you the warning and then you're going to do the best you can?
that's about it for right now. There is no talk about building public shelters. They basically feel that whatever structures exist now would be necessary or enough for the time being. And that is where they stand right now.
And there isn't like anything left from the Dharma Project that people could climb into? And
Well, we don't know of any secret bunkers that some rich people may have on the island.
Right.
Who knows? But there are probably some hidden possibilities somewhere on these islands, but none that I'm aware of.
That was a Lost reference for those of you that are like, what the heck is he talking about? So when with all the talk about this, are people concerned? You said that people are joking about it more than anything, but are people at all buying water? Are people buying plastic or masks or anything? Or is it pretty much just, well, that'll be the warning. I guess we'd head home if this happened and hope for the best.
It's business as usual here. It hasn't fazed anybody. There is no panic. The shelves are filled with water and bread and milk and everything you can think of right now. There is no, and the people that we've spoken to all say that they don't think that a nuclear attack would happen, even if it was, even though it is capable for them to do so. But it's pretty calm. I mean, after the sirens ended, it was eerie to hear them as they happened, but everyone was just moved on after the alert today.
And do you guys think much about North Korea? I mean, you are clearly the U.S. state closest. Most of the threats have been directed at Guam, but clearly that, you know, if this was going to happen, Hawaii would be a sensible target to try to start causing some problems. Do you guys think much about it, or is it, God, this is, you know, it's a lot of bluster, and of course we got to be prepared, but we just move on?
Well, civil defense is definitely thinking about it. I mean, they have us, we're the first state in the United States to start testing nuclear attack sirens, so at least our government is thinking about it, and there may be a few on the island, but as far as and we are, as the media goes here, we have been covering the steps that Hawaii has been taking to either be aware of it or prepare for it and helping educate the public. But again, the public seems to, you know, they're very thankful. Some of the comments we also see is that they are thankful that Hawaii has taken the steps to prepare. But most of it is, you know, they can't, you know, a lot of people, the reaction is, it's like, I can't believe we're in a time now that we're hearing nuclear attack warning sirens.
No kidding.
And really, it's just kind of a shock of that than the possibility of attack.
One last question about how you would be warned about it. You mentioned that, like, TV, radio broadcasts and texts to warn the residents along with these sirens.
Yes.
Now, I'm embarrassed to say this, Anthony, but my knowledge about what happens when a nuclear bomb is coming is relegated to the television movie The Day After. I don't know if you recall that from the early 80s, but there was this real scary movie about a nuclear attack on the United States, and it was called The Day After. And as I recall, I believe people knew the bombs were coming, and so they're all racing in their cars to get away or whatever. But something like, as the bomb enters the atmosphere, all the cars shut off. I don't know how to explain that. I believe people have told me that's true, that something like that would happen. And I'm just thinking, I know we trust radio and television. Signals can go out, though, and texting. I'm just worried about everybody relying on getting a text. Cell service can be so bad as it is. But in a nuclear threat, relying on the text to come through. Oh, God, I didn't get the text. What's going on? I didn't know. Seems like a scary way to have to find out about a bomb coming.
Yeah, and I guarantee you there's probably not going to be, you know, every single person in the state of Hawaii will be properly notified if something were to happen. I know there were a lot of people today who actually didn't even hear the sirens go off. So it is possible. I know there is, when a nuclear explosion occurs, there's an electromagnetic pulse, which would make any kind of electronic devices not function. The alert would happen before that would happen. So if somebody did have a device on them, they would at least know that it was coming. hopefully. There is a chance that there are going to be some people that are not aware or not familiar. And I know there are some people today who didn't even know what was going on today. We asked a few people, and they didn't even realize that there was even a nuclear attack siren warning test. So,
yeah, and I imagine as good as you try to set those things up, not everything is in a place that people are going to hear it, or they're in an office building, or they're somewhere that you're not necessarily going to hear that. Do you know, another quick question, so office buildings, things like that, have you heard of anyone saying, because sometimes businesses will do tornado drills or do fire drills, especially in a big, dense building. If, you know, there's a big building full of thousands of workers and these sirens go off, I imagine the buildings have to think about what kind of chaos that would cause. Has there been any talk of companies doing any sort of preparation for this? Or is this really just, this has happened and nobody else has kind of caught on to, you know, any need to do anything else to prepare as of yet?
We haven't been made aware of any companies or buildings that are doing so. And to say in my office, we haven't even discussed it yet either. So I think it's really just been kind of done on a high level on the government end. But it hasn't gotten down to the point where we're like, you know, like a fire drill in a building where we're doing nuclear drills or any kind of drill for a missile attack in buildings or offices yet.
Well, and you guys are reporting on you know, what happened today with the siren testing. Have you had any, as a news organization, has there been any internal discussion like, hey, guys, as long as we're talking about the possibility of nuclear attack, we should talk about what happens if that does happen, because while we might all be dead, if we're not, we need to be covering it. So you kind of got to be on call.
Yeah, I know in our office, in our newsroom, we've discussed, we've actually have a regular discussion because of hurricanes.
Sure.
When we have a hurricane that has hit the island here before, it's been weeks where they've had communications out and power out, and that's just with a hurricane. So naturally, if there were survivors after an attack or anything along those lines, it would probably be much, much worse as far as any kind of availability of communications. Or what would we do after the fact? So I know people are thinking about it, but nothing has really been done as far as making anything concrete.
Well, I wish you all the best. I hope that, of course, all these tensions settle down and we don't have to worry about anything, and Hawaii continues to get to be the beautiful island that it is. Civilbeat.org is the website to see more on the Honolulu Civil Beat. Anthony Quintano covers things there and takes pictures and writes stories for them. And we'll keep following you there. And Anthony, I hope we can touch base again.
I would like that very much. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone. Anthony Quintano with Honolulu Civil Beat, civilbeat.org. And you can see some video there of the tsunami and nuclear warnings that were tested just yesterday in Hawaii. We got news coming up in a little bit on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bobala with you here, 720 WGN. Our good friend Julia McFarlane from the BBC in London. I try not to do my accent for her because I don't want to embarrass myself. And I went into a Texas accent as I got out of my English.
Seriously, I don't know what you were trying to do there.
No, I'm doing my Marvin the Martian. That's pretty good.
That was
just,
all right.
Just like, who the hell? Oh, get out of here. That was good.
Roger, you don't know what you're talking about. I'm Marvin the Martian.
Come on. Come on. Wow.
Okay, it was pretty good.
It was good. Trust me.
Good. All right.
Anyways, our good friend Julia will jump on the phone to chat about it. I'm very excited about it, and it's not getting enough attention because we got too much crap going on here. For goodness sakes, people, Harry's getting married to an American divorcee.
Who went to school at Northwestern.
50 years ago, this would have been like all-out crazy scandal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but it's like his brother did it already.
Well, he didn't marry an American.
Doesn't matter. He's married already.
A biracial American who's divorced. It's such a beautiful thing that we have come that far. Mm-hmm. That quite honestly, here in America, I think we're all excited. There has been some controversy overseas about it in Britain. We'll talk to Julie about that, as well as ask her how they're looking at all of us these days. We'll find that out after the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. Heard the tone? It's 4 in the morning. Here's Roger with the news. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. If you're just getting up and joining us, it's a pretty chilly day here in Chicago. Some of the warmer weather from this week. I don't believe we'll be around much this weekend, right, Roger? It's not going to be that bad, though.
After Tuesday afternoon, it drops down. We've got a chance for some light flurries over the next 7 days after
Still
that.
No real snow in the forecast.
Not really.
Though, right?
No, nothing that you need to get out the shovels okay. or deal with.
All right. Well, yeah. Something that is, so there have been a lot of just craziness in America over the last, well,
really?
Let's face it, year. But especially this week, we've got indictments, we've got guilty pleas, we've got tax bills getting passed at like 2 in the morning Eastern time. We've got Matt Lauer. We've got a lot of craziness going on. There's no doubt about it. So one thing that kind of got overshadowed, it's a softer story, but it's still a fun story and one that certainly captures the attention of the whole world when it happens. There is a royal engagement in Britain. Joining us on the phone is our old friend Julia McFarlane from the BBC. Hey, Julia, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Matt. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being with us. Usually we're talking about such serious stuff, and I don't know, maybe you do consider this serious stuff. For us, it's a lot of fun. Prince Harry finally got engaged to an American, Meghan Markle. This is going to help soften our relations, I think, Julia.
Well, it's funny you say that, Matt, because on Monday when this announcement was made, it was the newsroom was in this like honeymoon mode. Everyone was smiling. We were all, you know, taking our feet off the accelerator of all the, you know, North Korea and everything that was happening. And we were looking up, you know, what dress is she going to wear? When might she get married? What church will they choose? And this lovely period of sort of happiness and, you know, looking at happy things lasted a whole sort of 48 hours, I guess, until the president retweeted an extremist group. So it was lovely while it lasted.
Yeah, well, but, so there is that. There's also that, you know, the president retweeted three videos from a British extremist group. I think the thing was it said Britain first and he's always America first. So he thought, hey, these are my kind of people. Probably not a lot of research went into that. And he just starts retweeting things. Your Prime Minister, Theresa May, scolded him for that, which he then promptly addressed and re-yelled back at the wrong Theresa May. So we had that going for us, too. We're really batting 1,000 this week.
Yeah. If to go into that, I mean, there was Wednesday when we all woke up and saw the president had retweeted three tweets from the deputy head of Britain First, that really went down like a lead balloon. Just some background. Britain First is probably the most extreme far-right group in the UK. There are several fringe groups, but they are really considered as the most extreme in the UK. They are far too unpalatable for even the likes of UKIP and other sort of right-wing movements, anti-immigration movements in the UK. And particularly since last year, the Yorkshire MP Jo Cox was murdered by a white supremacist called Thomas Mayer, who shouted Britain First as he stabbed her outside her constituency meeting. So for Westminster, I mean, I was working in Westminster on that day that Jo Cox was murdered, and it was a day I will never forget in my career. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And it shook Parliament to the core. It was such a rare sort of event that kind of it united everyone across the chamber, both sides of the chamber. It was, you know, it was a very, very stark, horrible day. And so for the president of the United States to retweet these three tweets of this group was something that really was met with absolute consternation. And the Commons went to urgent questions that day on this. The Home Secretary took an urgent question on the state, on the US President's state visit as a response to this. And the words that we heard flying across the Commons that day with reference to President Trump, members of Parliament were calling him fascist. They called him stupid. They called him spreading evil. One MP said he is either racist, incompetent, ignorant, or all three. These are words spoken by actual members of Parliament in a parliamentary session about the President of the United States, the closest ally of the United Kingdom. It was really quite unprecedented. Mm-hmm. And then it was also sort of exacerbated after, well, Theresa May, she made a statement when she was on her visit to the Middle East, and she said it was her spokesman said it was wrong for him to have done that, to have retweeted this group. And then
which is pretty soft language. I mean, pretty, you know, I'm sure they debated it and they talked about how are we going to address this. And they did it in as nice of a way as humanly possible, quite honestly.
Well, she strongly, yeah. Well, I mean, she strongly condemned the group. She said this group is abhorrent. They are completely against all of our principles. They are not British in their values. And then with reference to the president's tweets, her spokesman said that he should not have done that. And the next day, or later that night, and the next day when we all woke up, the following day, the president had, after one or two unsuccessful attempts to tag the right Theresa May in his tweet, he said, "Theresa May, don't focus on us. You know, focus on your own problem." And of course, everyone was in a tiz about this, and it was reported as president sort of attacking Theresa May. I personally think actually Mr. Trump was quite measured in that tweet. We can take his tweets as official statements now, I think. As Theresa May was at pains to not, she had to make her position clear that she believed what the president did with Britain First was wrong. But also, President Trump, he does not beat around the bush. He wears his heart on his sleeve, and he has used a lot of adjectives to describe his enemies, people he's angry with, and his tweet to Theresa May. Personally, I think showed a lot of restraint, actually. He has tended in the past, every now and then, quite often, to take criticism against him very personally and to react strongly to it. But I consider it to be a mild-mannered rebuke to Theresa May. He was just saying to her, don't focus on me, don't criticize me. I was retweeting videos about, the threat of Islamism as portrayed by Britain First in whatever crude way that they had portrayed this in these tweets.
Well, Julia, you're reading into his rebuke of her, because he didn't say all of that. He said, "Hey, we're doing just fine here. Worry about yourself." And you are showing such British kindness, the storied British kindness that we hear about, because you're being so measured and being, well, he really held back and he really just addressed, he was a jerk to Theresa May.
I think he did hold back. I absolutely think he did hold back. If we think of all the words that he uses to describe, some of the things he has said to
Kim Jong-un and others, yes, absolutely. But yeah, Theresa May just said he shouldn't have done that. He knows he shouldn't have done that. And quite honestly, I do feel like if he would have been with Theresa May at a meeting or somewhere where they were just talking and he said, "Oh, you know what, this terror thing you guys are dealing with, we're dealing with it too. I'm going to show some of these videos that shows what's going on there." And then she would have said, "From who?" And he said, "Britain First." She would have said, "Oh, my God, no, that's a crazy extremist group. You can't do that. Please don't do that. There's other ways." I believe that he would not have done it then. However, he didn't know. He didn't know, so he did it. And there's no way he's going to go, "Hey, I shouldn't have done that." Those words will never come out of his mouth. "Hey, I screwed up. Hey, I shouldn't have done that." Instead, he's a jerk to her back, saying, "Hey, worry about yourself. We're fine here." I'm sorry, but that was... you're right. What's sad to me, Julia, is that you're like, "You know what? He was pretty good about that," because that is how far fallen.
Don't misunderstand me. The outrage caused on this side of the Atlantic with the president's tweets, which everyone said was, was a out of line, which, you know, if that tweet had come from any other president or state leader, then it would have been hugely controversial. But given what we, given the language we see him using every day, I think he held back on what he said. But he couldn't let it lie because of how,
of course,
the nature of how he takes criticism as deeply personal. But I think if we look at his tweet, I think it is clear to him that he understands that he has a clash of principles with Prime Minister Theresa May, as Prime Minister Theresa May realizes, but these two leaders realize that, you know, there is at the moment, they are in a way experiencing two sides of the same coin. Britain is currently dealing with the Brexit vote and with a mood in this country that is, you know, that is changing and that has gone against sort of, you know, trends from the last year of what we have always seen of globalization as being a positive trend. We are seeing backlash of it. We are seeing populism. We are seeing all the rules being upended, as in the United States, which is why I think that Britain and what's happening in Britain and the national conversation in Britain when it comes to UKIP, Brexit, vote leave, why all of this is on Trump's radar in a way that all of these moods and these parts of the national dialogue were never picked up across in the US, because as close as we are as allies, our national conversation was never much interest to the United States. But yeah. President Trump, you know, he is friends with Nigel Farage, he's friends with Piers Morgan. He has been following Brexit, and he's been following what's happening in the UK because he sees it as similar to what is, you know, to this, you know, the mood in the US, which, you know, has shaken the country to its core from the election last year when all of the rules were broken. And so I think that if we look back at his tweet, I think he, yeah, I mean, come on, if you read it, it's different from his other angry tweets. He does actually sound like he's holding back quite a lot.
I know you see it that way, but to me, it's because she didn't say anything to him at all other than he should not have done that. I mean, that is such the minimal that could have been said. And so for him to be so flippant back drives me a little crazy. Like, hey, worry about yourselves. We're doing fine here. It's like, oh, come on, just shut up.
It could have been a lot worse.
Of course it could have been. But that's what's sad to me is that you guys are like lowering the bar enough that you're like, oh, well, it could have been worse. He could have been, you know, look at how he is to everybody else. Yeah, but
this is my interpretation. It was his tweets caused absolute consternation here.
Well, good.
And it was, this is just my thoughts that when I saw his tweet, I thought it made it clear that he does not get on with Theresa May on a personal level, but yeah. He held back quite a lot, I think.
Let me ask you one last question about that, because I really wanted to talk about the engagement. But those videos that he retweeted, were those real videos or those staged videos?
So one of them was utterly fake news. It was a video that appeared or purported to show from the caption Muslim man beating up Dutch injured man with crutches, and actually that was total rubbish. It was both of the men in those videos were Dutch nationals born and bred in the Netherlands, and he was not even Muslim, and this was spelled out very clearly from the embassy, from the Netherlands embassy to the USA, which tweeted this and was like, this video is actually fake news. The man in this video was born in the Netherlands and was raised in the Netherlands and was not even a Muslim. So that was, you know, there is a danger when the president, who's got almost 50 million followers on Twitter, circulates false messages to his citizens, to people around the world, because people will take anything that he says as fact. And as a president who has said that he condemns fake news and he's against it, it was something that he should have looked at, should have wondered if it was real before sharing it. But will he start doing that in the future? Who knows? One can only hope.
Yeah. So the interesting thing that came out of this, I don't know how much you follow this, but I imagine you heard this too. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the press secretary, was asked about these videos being fake. And the response was, it doesn't matter if those videos were real. The threat is real. And that's how that was spun.
So she said, I'm not talking about the nature of the video. You're focusing on the ring, on the wrong thing. The threat is real. And that's what the president is talking about. I mean, that was seen here as clearly the White House backtracking, realizing that, you know, the video is fake, but not really wanting to admit that it had done anything wrong by circulating these videos. I mean, of course they wouldn't, because the video was fake news. And this is, you know, this is a president who frequently calls out what he sees as the fake news and says you can't trust the mainstream media. And yet these groups that he endorses by sharing their content on Twitter are exactly what he is coming out and condemning.
Okay, let's get to the fun stuff. Meghan Markle, American, divorced, biracial, marrying Harry. What was the I know that when it came out, that, you know, and I didn't even realize, I don't think most people in America really know Meghan Markle that well. She is an actress, but she's not a really famous one. She's definitely most famous now for dating Harry. She's in a show that's somewhat seen here, but it's not on a very popular network. It gets some press, but Meghan was definitely not a household name before Harry. And so most people didn't realize she was biracial or anything like that. And I think we're in an age where that's not cared about as much, certainly. And that's a good thing. But there was some consternation in Britain, we heard. I think more when they were dating at first. There was didn't the palace have to come out with a statement about getting people to lay off of Meghan Markle?
Yeah, so they were, I think the first reports of them sort of going out were around about this time last year, and there was horrible stuff in the tabloids and online. I have to say, I hadn't come across any. The first I heard of Meghan Markle was when the palace had put out that statement. So because they had been at the start of their relationship, they spent about 4 months in complete obscurity, and no one had found out about them. But it eventually, after a few months, they had been found out, and there were sort of rumors spread like wildfire across the internet. And there was horrible things referencing her biracial heritage, the fact that she was a divorcee, the fact that she was American. And then the palace took this unprecedented step. And when that statement sort of dropped, it was just such a huge shock for all of us, because it was so unusual for the palace to come out like this and to come out with a statement also when the relationship is in such early days. So that also kind of signaled the importance and sort of the intensity of this relationship. And Prince Harry sort of issued this stark warning for the press to back off. And I mean, the relationship between the press and the royals here in the UK is obviously the family is of huge interest to everyone in this country. But we, of course, live in the shadow of what happened with Princess Diana. And so for the British press, even the tabloids, who get most of their circulation out of printing stories of the royal family, they do generally play ball with the royal family since the death of Diana because of this. And so even though there is an absolute maelstrom of interest around Harry and Meghan, they are going to be followed round the clock. Hopefully that that conducive sort of relationship will continue to go forward. But it has been interesting because certain outlets here in the UK, I won't mention which ones, you could probably guess. Since the engagement, seeing how they have covered the royal engagement and going into a bit more about Meghan's background have been quite interesting, because Meghan is largely, I think she's largely very, very popular in the UK, actually. I think a lot of people see her as a breath of fresh air. I think Harry, who is the enfant terrible of the royal family, who, I mean, I can just to give you an example, my mother has often sort of, you know, said to me, oh, what are we going to do about Harry? He needs to find a wife. It's like she's talking about someone in our family, you know. She said, oh, I just want him to find a lovely woman and settle down. And I think that's kind of how many people in the UK feel about, I mean, the royal family is, I mean, it's a family that is familiar to everyone. And we feel like we know them. We've grown up with them.
Sure.
And, you know, and so that is why you get such familiarity with it. And so I think the fact that Harry has found a woman who has a name for herself in her own right. She is beautiful. She's just got a radiant smile. She has a history of activism from way before.
From when she was a child. Him.
I read a story that she wrote a letter to First Lady Hillary Clinton when she was 11 because she was so offended that an advert for a soap manufacturer made it seem like women belonged in the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, I love her. Like, as soon as I heard that, I thought that was, you know, that was a good sign.
Yeah, no kidding. And we would have never known that had this not all come about. I mean, she was an actress, a working actress of some renown, but not that famous. So now we hear she's going to retire from acting. She's going to move to England. She is going to, I believe, convert to the Church of England. Is that right? And then they'll be married at a chapel there?
So we all assumed that she was Catholic because she had gone to a Catholic college, and I think her father is Roman Catholic. But the palace put out a statement a couple of days ago saying that she was Protestant, but that she was going to be baptized and confirmed. So I think it's probably I think in that case she might have been born Protestant but has never been baptized.
Okay.
So.
And then they're going
to
live in...
I have to say, if she had been Catholic, that would have just been one other sort of thing, because there is a little bit of beef with the royal family marrying Catholics. I think legally they are able to now, but because the Queen is the head of the Church of England,
right?
That you'd have this sort of the triumvirate of Meghan being a divorcee, an American and a Catholic. So she at least has, she has one side that is slightly more acceptable.
See,
people who are a little stuck in the past. But, you know, I think this is wonderful. I think this is exactly, you know, the kind of thing that the monarchy really needs to stay relevant and to, you know, move into the 21st century. And I saw a tweet a couple of days ago, which I thought was actually quite astute. And it said, it referenced that Prince William married a commoner and Prince Harry is marrying a biracial American divorcee. Princess Diana is shaking the royal family from the grave. And I think what that sort of says to me is, I think it's absolutely true that it's the legacy of Princess Diana for raising these boys to know their own minds, to be true to themselves, and to, you know, take things in their stride. And I think the way when William married Kate, that also caused a storm because she wasn't in the aristocracy. She was a commoner. She was someone who he met at university. And she broke down those barriers first. And in a way, Kate sort of paved the way for Meghan to come through. So I think these two boys who've been raised by a strong, independent woman who knew her own mind, it's so reflected in the choices that they have made.
Well, and it's neat because I think it's important for everybody to believe that they can be royalty. And by marrying people outside of the traditional bounds, they have brought that back into a reality. And also, I think, you know, I didn't follow the royal family much at all here in America, of course. Princess Diana, we did, and the wedding for them and everything. But Prince Charles was always over here seen as so stuffy. I knew nothing about if he did great charitable works his whole life. I didn't know about it. But with Prince Harry and Prince William, we hear so much about the work they're doing. They really have, at least from my mind over here, brought the royal family into the next century in a way that does help keep them relevant and important. And, you know, if you're going to be able to sort of, I think a lot of people look at the royal family sometimes as living off the public dime, but by doing such good works and by being such an important facet of British society for the rest of the world to see, I think it's amazing, you know, how I mean, think about where we are right now, that there is a royal family that lives like they do. It's really, like, surprising in some ways. So I think they're doing a great job of at least from my small American mind over here, being very important.
They do. And the next time there is a massive argument about how much the renovation of Buckingham Palace is going to cost the taxpayer, or whether they're going to commission another royal yacht at to the tune of tens of millions of pounds, and everyone starts complaining about why do we have a royal family, that's when the popular characters such as William, Kate, Harry and Meghan will sort of be the monarchy's sort of ace of spades. But they are... The monarchy is largely popular in the UK. There are, of course, sort of very Republican oppositions to the royal family as an institution, but they are largely very popular in the UK. And I think mostly over the years that's been down to the leadership of the Queen.
Yeah.
So, with regards to Meghan, I think the fact that she is who she is, I think is such a wonderful step. And saying this as myself, as a mixed race girl growing up, there were no role models who fit my background. There were no women in the public eye or even in movies. There weren't even any fictional mixed race women that I could have looked up to, right? And I think the fact that Meghan is someone who has a diverse background, who came from an ordinary family and has made this journey and is becoming literally an American princess. Not formally, she will most likely be a duchess, but I think she will always be known to you guys across the pond as their American princess, as their Grace Kelly of the 21st century.
Yeah.
I think a lot of little girls will look up to her and think, you know, anything is possible. And isn't that exactly the American dream?
It is. It is. Although it's weird for us to say right now, Julia, that we want our little girls looking up to somebody who became a princess, because we don't want them to think that's what they need to be. Right. So there's that on the one side.
Yeah,
and then there's
course.
The other
yeah.
side of that, too. I want her to become princess and then go kick ass and like raise money and do great things and conquer the world, not just, you know, have babies and be in the background. And I imagine
what you're going to do. But I hate to break it to you, Matt, but most Uh-oh. Young girls, when they're,
still
when they're
be
young,
princesses.
We all want to be princesses when we're that age. When we're teenagers, we want to be president or we want to be prime minister. But when we're little kids, we watch Disney films and we all want to be Tinkerbell and princesses.
Well,
so.
and that's okay. We still need to get to be kids
okay.
at some point in our lives. Absolutely.
Because
there's so much going on when we get older. Enjoy those young years while we can. Julia McFarlane from the BBC. Follow her on Twitter. She's a great follow and a great reporter for the BBC. It's always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for jumping on today.
Nice to see you, Matt.
You too. We'll talk to you soon. Julia at the BBC. Follow her on Twitter at Julia McFarlane. All right. News is next. We got to catch up. 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. We've got about 14 more minutes left of the Matt Bubala Show. I posted something on Friday on... maybe it was Friday, maybe it was Thursday, I don't remember, a couple days ago on our Facebook fan page. If you're so inclined and you're on Facebook, please go give us a like, the Matt Bubala Show on Facebook. And it was a story about Aaron Rodgers. Did you see that this week, Roger?
Yeah, I did.
Roger Rodgers?
Yeah, Roger Rodgers.
Aaron Rodgers in town last week or a couple weeks ago when the Bears played the Packers.
Mm-hmm.
A young Chicago mom and her son were out walking Michigan Avenue on Saturday night before the game. And her son, who's like, I think 7 to 9 years old, I can't remember what, they're like at a stoplight on Michigan Avenue. He says, Mom, I think that's Aaron Rodgers. And she's like, oh, get out of here. Aaron Rodgers wouldn't be walking around. They get to the next light and she looks at him and she said quietly, she said, are you? And he looked at her and said, yes, I am. And she said, you know, I did it quietly because I didn't want to disrupt him.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Here he's out, you know, and there are other people around. And so, he talks to her for a minute or two, and then some other people recognize him and are taking pictures, so her and her son keep walking. And they thought that was just the coolest thing. Well, they get a couple blocks up, and at another light, he comes up next to him again and starts chatting with them and talking to the son, and he's apologizing for being a Bears fan. And he said, don't apologize. You're from Chicago. You should be a Bears fan.
Mm-hmm.
And was just the nicest guy in the world.
Well, of course. What did you think he was going to be?
some athletes are jerks. You know that.
Yeah.
But this is different, Roger.
Yeah.
Him talking to her at the first light, saying hi, yes, I am, saying hi to the sun, that's a decent human being.
Yeah.
Two blocks later, engaging in conversation with them and chatting with them for a few different blocks, as she reported, is just really, really nice to hear. Because, you know, athletes are paid a lot of money and they deal with a lot of people. So for somebody to stay humble, be kind and nice to somebody really like that drives me insane. Because we're supposed to hate the stupid Packers. And it drives me nuts that Aaron Rodgers is so hard not to damn root for. Because he always seems like a good guy.
Yeah.
He plays the game ridiculously well, plays it right. And then you hear the story. He's here in Chicago where we're all just hate him. And he just embarrasses us for the last decade.
You know, he was on injury.
Gets him to win just by standing on the sideline, apparently. And here he's a great guy. It's like, oh, come on. So that,
another way to look at that.
Well.
He was stalking her.
What is wrong with him? She's got a child. Call Protective Services, that weirdo.
Two blocks later, God. He comes up behind them. Come on.
So that story's on my Facebook page. So give us a like, Matt Bubala Show on Facebook. The cool part, so then the mom reports that she goes into another store with her son, and now she's all giddy and excited because the son is like, you know, picked him out and was so excited about it. So she sees some woman, I think, wearing something Green Bay in a store and just can't help. She goes, you wouldn't believe who I just met. Blah, 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 blah. And look at this picture. It was Aaron Rodgers. And the mom's like, oh, my son plays for the Packers.
Oh, geez.
It was, I think, Ty Montgomery's mom or something like that. God. Which also, so that the mom of this player, that's the little boy's favorite player. And so as they're walking away, he says, I wanted to ask Aaron about her son.
God.
What a crazy story.
And then that's the story the kid goes to the school the next day to tell about, and nobody believes him.
Well, I bet he got a selfie.
I don't know.
Oh, they did. I saw it in the paper.
They
did?
Okay.
Yeah, Aaron's right. bent down, like taking a picture with the little boy. It's adorable.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Back to Green Bay and being mean to people.
By the way, I got another bucket list check off.
Okay.
And you know,
Roger, I've asked you about the bucket list. You're like, I already work at WGN. What else could I want? Like?
Right.
And I've been mad at you about that.
I know.
What'd you do?
Well, it was I added it to my bucket list
I realized I had a chance to do it. Split or something like that.
No, but okay. I had a pretty good night Thursday.
Okay.
No, Wednesday at the WGN Hawks holiday party.
Yeah, did I get an invite to that?
And yes,
I
you did.
It? Are you sure?
Yeah.
I got to check that damn
You got to check that.
Did
Put
you
it
go,
on
Jess?
VIP on your phone. That was some time back that they put out the word. It was like a month ahead of time.
The one thing See, what I don't understand is there's a curling thing.
Oh, curling.
Oh, see, maybe,
the sport
maybe I'm on a separate list. Steph sent me an invitation to go curling with some people here on Monday. Well, I can't do that.
I didn't get that one.
And I don't really care that much to do that, but I would have loved to have skated at the United
Center.
Well,
you know what? I think she. There's so much going on. She can't invite everyone to everything.
Yeah. Well,
so
maybe
she invites different ones to different things.
Maybe I'm just special, Roger.
But I think you are special in so many special ways. So after spending about 20 minutes trying to find where our daughter and grandkids were, because they kind of got lost in the United Center once they finally got there.
Right.
You
didn't tell them just go to the big sheet of ice in the middle? That's where we'll be? It's kind of hard to miss.
Well, actually, they ended up one level above us and looked down and saw everybody. It's like, oh, there they are. They got completely lost.
It was lost. Great.
So they got there, and the kids are eating, you know, having a little something to eat. And they can't go skating because they don't have the skates, and it's pretty late. They only skated from 6 to 8.
Okay.
So off on the – there's this guy standing there, a younger guy, standing off to the side. And it's Troy Murray.
Oh, cool.
And he's got this, you know, stack of photos. And I go, guys, it's Troy Murray. And they go, okay. Because they don't follow hockey.
Sure, sure.
But so he was so nice. He signed to each of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what did they do the next day at school? You know, they came running into their classroom with this signed. Hey, I'm at Troy Murray. And, of course, all the kids who know who Troy Murray is and follow hockey,
sure,
you know, went crazy.
Very excited.
So Troy and I talked for a while, the first time I've ever met him.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't think he knew me from Adam, but he did. Because I'm a voice that he listens to
now,
after the game.
Did he really know you, or did he give you the Ronnie Santo, hey, big boy?
No. He knew the voice. You're the guy doing the news, because they listen.
When I'm driving home.
When they're driving home. And then as we're getting ready to leave, John Weideman's there.
Mm-hmm. Also a very nice guy.
Very nice guy. And I had to... Kevin McDonough was there from the sales department,
mm-hmm.
and we had talked about something earlier. And as I'm leaving, I says, "You know, I'm going to take care of this tomorrow. Don't worry about it." And I said, "John, how are you, Roger Badish?" He goes, "Roger Badish." I'm taking it back. I'm like, because I don't think anybody listens to me.
Yeah,
you know. And I go, I says, "Nice to finally meet you." And he says, "Hey, nice to meet you too. I listen to you when we're driving home." I go,
that's cool.
I walk away going, this is cool. You know, wow.
You're all giddy as you left.
I was
the
very
party.
Giddy. I'm starstruck. I'm old, but I still can get starstruck.
So, what was the bucket list part? Skating at the United States?
No, it's meeting those two guys.
On your bucket list was meeting Troy and John.
Yeah. Why not?
We have got to work
talk
on this
about
bucket
them.
List, Roger. We have got to work on this. Listen, Troy and John, great guys, nice
yes.
guys. I've met them too. I had to shoot a video with them once. Good people.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to be on my deathbed going, thank God I got to meet John and Troy. You know?
Well,
I'm just saying,
Roger.
You got
your bucket list.
We
got to
aim, a little higher. Come on, baby.
Come on.
Come on, baby.
Oh, my God, there's ABC News.
Oh,
be
God.
Quiet.
You
they're
go get
loud.
That. I'm going to get a break okay. in, and then we're going to say hi to Orion from WGN West. Next, 720 WGN. Matt Bubalo here, 720 WGN. Thanks for being with us, staying up all night with us, or getting up early with us here on 720 WGN. We'll be back next week at 2 a.m., like us at the Matt Bubala Show on Facebook, Matt Bubala on Twitter. Joining us right now from WGN West in Arizona, it's Orion Samuelson. Good morning, Big O.
Well, good morning to you, Matt. And what was that, Facebook and tweet? Oh, how do I get in touch with you?
So if you want to join our Facebook fan page, it's the Matt Bubala Show on Facebook, or I'm just on Twitter at Matt Bubala.